conditions were a little better there in Missouri than in some other parts of the country where the teams were training.
Well, of course, I don't know what the other spring training camps were, but we really didn't have it too bad in Cape Girardeau. We did have an indoor place where we could take batting practice on bad days when it was cold, and we had a fairly good baseball diamond. And really, the weather that, even though it was only 100 miles or so south of St. Louis, the weather wasn't that bad that spring.
Good. Now, did you train there for 3 years? I mean, did you go 43 through 45?
I believe it was something like that. I don't recall.
Okay. Was there a college there? I mean, did you have a college diamond to practice on outside, or?
That's been a few years ago. To tell you the truth, I don't even remember too much about the field. But as I remembered, it was a good one, and I actually remember more about the indoor place where we had the batting cage, which was something new back in those days.
What was it? A field house type?
Sort of a field house, yes, with a net, long net, for where you could take batting practice. Hitting against a pitching machine.
What about travel restrictions? Did the Browns have trouble getting Pullmans?
Not really, no. We had fairly good accommodations most of the time. Sometimes when there was a lot of troop movements and so forth, conditions weren't too good, and, we didn't always have first-class accommodations. But after all, the boys that were fighting the war, well, they should have come first.
Sure. What about food or gas rationing? Do you have any interesting stories about those?
Not really. The only interesting story that I can think of was the fact when we won the pennant in 1944, my family, my mother and brothers and all of my friends here in the East, they did pool their gas rationing and all piled into automobiles and took off for St. Louis, and they made it. But other than that, in fact, 1 year I didn't take my car to St. Louis because I couldn't drive it from here to St. Louis. I just did without an automobile. Mm-hmm. I got rides with some of the players that happened to live in that area, and they did have automobiles.
I see. Did you take an apartment when you were in St. Louis, or did you live in a hotel?
No, we always lived at, except for 1 year, at the Gatesworth Hotel in St. Louis, which is in. My wife and I were back there just about a year ago, and visited the old Gatesworth Hotel, which is now a hotel for elderly people, but it looks the same and it's kept up nice. We had quite a reunion there. It was a reunion of St. Louis Cardinal ball players and New York Yankee ball players.
Fine. Now, were you married during the war?
Yes, I was.
Any children?
Yes, I have two daughters.
I see. But they were born before the war. In other words, they were alive during the war.
One of them was born, I think it was 1943, during the war.
I see.
The other one was born just before the World Series in 1947.
I see. So you said that you lived in the Gatesworth for 1 year and the rest of the time you had...
No. I lived there for... My wife and I lived there for 7 of the 8 years that I played there.
I understand. And was the Gatesworth near Sportsman's Park? Did you commute to and from by walking?
No, you couldn't walk, but it wasn't too far. It was out near the St. Louis Park, and near the zoo, and which is world famous, the St. Louis Zoo, of course. Because it had a beautiful setting there, and a lot of the ball players stayed there.
So you just hop in a cab and go to and from?
No, actually, we would pool. There were other ball players, as I say, who lived there, and maybe 3 or 4 of us would ride in one of the ball players' car, and we'd take turns driving, and then the wives would come out later and also sort of a pool.
Sure.
With the other wives.
Now, In 1942, if I'm not mistaken, the Browns had a good year. They finished third. And in 43, they went down to sixth. Any specific reasons that you can think of why that happened? Had you lost certain players after the 42 season?
We did lose some ball players, it's true, but actually we didn't lose as many as some of the other clubs. And there's no question, of course, but what the fact that we won the pennant in 1944 was due to the fact that some of the other clubs had lost, you know, some of their superstars, as they call them today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, the Browns were loaded with 4Fs. It was an unusual amount for one club. They were able to...
Yes, we were, and I know people resented the fact that, well, just in my own case, I'd had back trouble from 1939 all through my big league career, and had been to doctors in Texas, Baltimore, St. Louis, spent 2 weeks in Boston at a hospital trying to get rid of this back trouble that I'd had. Now, everybody said, well, if he can play baseball, he can fight in the Army. But it was a lot different, really. I could go out and play a baseball game for 2 hours in the afternoon. Then I could come home after the ball game and lie down and rest for 2 or 3 hours. But you can't do that in the Army. If you're out on the, doing maneuvers and so forth and packing your pack is right, you can't say, Sergeant, my back hurts, I want to go lie down for 2 or 3 hours. So right. It was a big difference, really. And I know people did resent the fact that a lot of us were 4F and were playing baseball and not in the service, but I think we had a legitimate reason, really. It's like the Army doctor that examined me down in Camp Lee, Virginia. And after his examination, he says, listen, he says, we don't want you in the Army. He said, we have enough trouble with taking men into the Army with good backs that wind up with bad backs. Why take a man into the Army that already has back trouble? He says, you're better off doing just what you're doing.
What did you do during the off-season? Did the government insist that you do war-related work in the off-season, or were you more or less free to do what you please?
No, I was actually free to do what I pleased in the wintertime. And there were no, you know, war plants around Washington, D.C., this area, so, you know, it wasn't a case of where I could go work in a war plant or anything mm-hmm. like that.
What did you do in the off-season? I'm just curious. Did you just sit around and relax, or did you take a civilian, well, a regular job, and say?
The only... Other than the fact that I did this all my life in the wintertime, that is, I came home and hunted and fished all winter. Mm-hmm. But the one winter during the war, I managed a theater in Virginia.
Certainly, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, the Browns set an American League record. I don't know if it still stands for 9 consecutive victories at the start of the season. You really got off to a good start.
Yeah, we won the first 9 ball games of the season, and I've told this story many times after that. Before that, I believe if we'd even split those games, because if we'd split them, we wouldn't have won the pennant, because we didn't win it until the last day, actually. But the fact that we won the first 9 ball games made us sit up and take notice of the rest of the league. And then we said, hey, you know, we're in first place. We're as good as any ball club in this league now. So we just got that winning attitude from winning the first 9 ball games, and we just kept it all year long. And there's no question of what. I think if we'd have even won 6 of the first 9, I don't think we would have come anywhere near winning the pennant. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we won 9 in a row, as I say, made us sit up and take notice. And I think that was the real big factor. Because let's face it, it's like the old Yankees. When they walked on the field, they figured they were better than anybody else. And they weren't always that much better than the other team. But they had that spirit, a figured the 2 years that I spent with them, that was the way we felt when we walked on the field. We figured we were going to beat the other club, and mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, the other club had the defeatist attitude, especially when playing the Yankees.
Now let's jump ahead to the point where, if I'm not mistaken, the Browns were out in front most of the year, and then around September, I think you went into a slump, or August, something like that, and the Red Sox, the Yankees, and the Tigers, and you were kind of bunched together. At that time, did you still think you had a chance, or did morale sag a little bit at that point?
Well, morale did sag a little near the end of the year. That, in fact, a turning point came in Chicago, and Luke Sewell, I credit Luke Sewell with changing the whole pattern because of the fact that we were in a slump and some of the players were arguing and not getting along, and he held a meeting. He says, hey, we still have a chance to win this pennant. Let's stick together the rest of the year and pull for each other. And from that point on, it just turned everything around, really, and we began to win again, and we just got back in the groove again. And even when we went into the last four games of the season, we were one game behind Detroit. It looked like it would be almost impossible to catch up, because Detroit was playing Washington, a last place club. We were playing the Yankees, who still had an outside chance to win the pennant. We both played doubleheaders on a Friday. We won one of those doubleheaders by Gutteridge leading off the ball game with a double and eventually scoring. And that was the only hit we got in the ball game. We won the ball game 1-0.
I understand that in all four games, the Yankee pitchers were good. I know Baroy pitched one, and didn't Tiny Bonham pitch another? I think they threw under seven hits each game, and you still beat them four out of four.
Yeah.
And that's really clutch baseball.
Yes, it was.
Of course, you had good pitching from your people.
Yes, we did.
What was the celebration like after Chukwuka? See, what was it, 5-2 on the final day? I think he threw a six-hitter in New York.
Yeah, in St. Louis.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm sorry.
It happened in St. Louis.
Right.
Well, it was pretty hectic and pretty wild, I'll tell you. In fact, it was the only day that the Browns actually filled the ballpark.
Oh, really?
The whole year, yes. In fact, I think they turned them away that year. So I'm just guessing it must have been 2 hours or more before we ever got out of the clubhouse, you know, and were able to get to our cars. And of course, we had a big celebration at the Chase Hotel after the ball game. It was just unbelievable that we could beat the Yankees 4 in a row. Detroit split with Washington.
I forget the gentleman's name. It may have been, I want to say Barnes, but I don't think it's Barnes. I think he was the owner of the club.
Yeah, Donald Barnes was the owner of the club.
Some man wrote a history of the Browns team for Sport Magazine in the early 50s, and he said after the last putout, some fans just sat there at Sportsman's Park. They were kind of stunned by the whole thing.
Well, I don't recall what happened. I know I caught the last ball that was hit, a foul pop fly down the right field line. I caught the ball, as I say, over my shoulder going away from it. Mm-hmm. Of course, after I caught the ball, the game was over, and I'd put it for the clubhouse to get out of the mob.
Sure.
So I don't know what happened as far as the fans go, but I know they didn't leave for a long time. And of course, we didn't see what was going on in the stands either, because we were all up in the clubhouse.
Now, Frank Graham Jr. wrote an article. In fact, it was this article that excited my interest in the War Years. It was called When Baseball Went to War, and it appeared in Sports Illustrated, I think, in 1967. And he quoted, who was it, Gutteridge, I think, in later years, as saying that you were loosey-goosey. Zerillo was chipping golf balls into some little doohickey in the dugout, or maybe it was Ellis Clary, and With Sewell went out to coach third base, he had a football game on. So, do you want to comment on that?
Well, Ellis Clary, yes. He was the kind of a guy that was good for a ball club, especially when he was on the bench and not playing. Because he did. He kept everybody laughing and loose, as you say. He was a good man to have on the ball club. And it's funny about Ellis Clary. As soon as he got in the ball game, he wanted to fight everybody.
That's what I heard.
His personality just changed. Yeah, he'd fight you and...
So he wasn't like Gray then off the field.
He was the most lovable, and I've always said that he's the funniest man that ever put on a baseball uniform, off the field, that is.
But he was a fighter on the field.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Was he, am I correct in thinking he was one of these guys that didn't mind being hit by pitches and he'd try and get in the way of one just to get on?
Yeah, he'd try to beat you any way he could when he was in the ball game. Mm-hmm. But when he was not in the ball game, as I say, he was always clowning on the bench. He was a great football enthusiast, and it's possible, I don't recall that he ever listened to a football game while we were playing a baseball game, but it is possible.
Uh-huh. But certainly wasn't through lack of interest. I mean, it was just a question of staying, keeping the ball club loose, I'm sure.
That's right.
If Clary cared that much when he was on the field, I'm sure he cared that day.
No question about it.
Now, the Browns had a reputation, though, as being kind of a tough team. I mean, combative individuals. You had Jakubi, you had Gray. Didn't Tex Shirley throw the ball into the stands one day when he was taken out?
Nelson
Potter and George Case had a fight one day.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they weren't. They wouldn't.
Heartbreaker.
I'll never forget that.
Looks like threw someone out of third base.
I'll never forget that one because I won the first one with a home run, and I believe it was the 11th inning. We were the visiting club. Cardinals were the home club there. On the top of the 10th or 11th, I've forgotten which it was. I led off and hit a ball in the right center off the screen that just missed being a home run by about 6 feet either way. If I'd have pulled it a little more, it would have gone on the roof. If I'd hit it a little further in right center, it would have gone into the open bleachers. So anyway, I wound up with a double. And Mark Chrisman bunted on the next pitch. And to this day, I still, and even the movies of the World Series film, I still argue that I was, could have been.
So you were the man.
I could have been called.
It
could have been called either way, safe or out.
Yeah. I didn't realize you were the man who was going
third. I have a film upstairs that shows me sliding into third. Whitey Kurowski's the third baseman. And even in slow motion, it looks like it could have been a tie. As to whether I could have been, I argued with the umpire on the play. I thought I was safe. But anyway.
Kurowski was my first interview, my first one, and he remembered that play without having to be prompted. Of course, I had asked him about, the previous year, he had been involved in another play like that, and Johnny Lindell had crashed into him and sent him flying.
Yeah.
And the ball in one direction and him in the other. Well, then, if I'm not mistaken, in the third game you came back, got a few more hits, and Jack Kramer won. I think he beat Teddy Wilkes.
I almost won the second game with another home run, and then in the third game, I got three hits, 3 for 3. I think drove in 2 runs and scored 2 of the 5 runs, something like that. I counted for, 3 of the 5 runs. But after that, as you say, we never did come back to even come close to winning, I don't believe, any of the next 3 ball games.
Mm-hmm. I think Sewell sent something like 5 or 6 pinch hitters up, and every one of them struck out or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, the bench just didn't come through.
No, it didn't.
I'd like to talk about some of the Brown players. Before I start mentioning individual names, is there anyone on the 44 or 45 teams that you'd like to comment on? We've already talked about Clary and Jakubi. Any others that you'd like to mention?
Well, they were, of course, Vern Stevens was great. that year, one of the great little, he's not little, he was small and as far as height goes, but he was one of the strongest guys that ever played baseball.
Oh, really? He was strong?
Oh, yeah, strong as a bull. Mm-hmm. One of the nicest guys. Did a great job at short, was a good hitter. Of course, Don Gutteridge was, he was a stanky type ball player. He couldn't do much except win you ball games and hustle.
He was a real scrapper?
Yes, he was.
What about Mark Chrisman?
Mark Chrisman played a good, steady third base and had a good year for us that year. Mike Krivich, we got Mike Krivich from the White Sox. And Mike had a great year for us. And Sewell, luckily, Sewell rested Mike every now and then. But Mike did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
Red Hayworth and, oh, what's his name?
Mancuso.
Yeah, Frank Mancuso, yeah. They alternated catching, and I've said this over and over. I think it was in the cards for us to win the pennant that year because neither Red nor Frank could catch a pop fly. Pop foul fly, you know.
Oh, really? In back of the plate?
Yeah, in back of the plate. And then normally when a catcher drops a foul pop fly, it got to be a thing with them, you know. They were so bad at it. But they would drop those balls and we'd come back and the pitcher would get the hitter out. But normally when that something like that happens, a catcher drops a foul fly, the next pitch the guy hits a home run or gets a base hit. But it didn't happen to them that year. It just seemed like it was in the cards for us to win the pennant.
Hmm. What about...
But of course, had some Nelson Potter and Denny Gale. I was had real good years. Jakuki came right out of nowhere and had a good year. Al Hollingsworth did a great job for us.
Moncrief.
And Bob Moncrief. Johnny Nigling and... Well, we just, it was a really, this is, it's an old saying, but it did get to be a team effort, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, let's comment briefly on the other outfielders. How about Milt Burns?
Yeah, Milt Burns, he did a good job. When he played, he didn't play all the time. Gene Moore played, alternated a lot. Gene Moore, my roomie, one of the nicest guys that ever played baseball.
Really?
Yeah, he had a good year for us.
Mm-hmm.
Chet Labs, of course, hit the two home runs the last day of the season that won the pennant for us, and he did a good job.
Anyone else that you'd like to comment on the club? I think we've covered just about everybody.
Just about everybody, yes.
Now, I'd like to ask one thing in relation to Pete Gray. What was the reaction of the players initially when he went to spring training in 45? I mean, here's this guy that they brought up from Memphis. Did the players view it as a stunt, like this man was here for publicity purposes, or did they take him seriously? I mean,
well, of course, we didn't know. We'd heard about him from the minor leagues.
He'd had a great year with Memphis. He'd been voted the Southern Association's most valuable player.
That's right. But I really don't recall what our attitude was as far as Pete playing for us until after we got into the season. And even though he was a miracle man in a lot of ways, he still couldn't do as good a job as a man with two arms, let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you feel he took too much time tucking the glove under the arm and squeezing the ball out?
That's right. There's no question but what on, like, ground balls, he couldn't field ground balls and shift his glove or catch fly balls and shift his glove and throw the ball as quick as a man with two arms could do it. And there's no question but what he cost us, well, quite a few ball games. And I'll be frank with you, we did get to resent the fact that they played Pete Gray over a man with two arms just to draw people in the ballpark. We felt it was unfair to us for a man with one arm to be playing when we were trying to win a pennant. When we knew, and everybody knew, there was no question of what a man with two arms could do a better job. As I say, Pete Gray was a miracle man with one arm. It was unbelievable what he could do with one arm.
Mm-hmm. But he still wasn't
up to... But he still couldn't do the job like a man with two arms could do.
Do you mind if I include that in the book?
No, I don't mind that.
Okay. Then what happened after the 45 season? Were you sold to the A's or traded?
I was traded to Dick Siebert, to the Philadelphia, yes.
Mm-hmm. And that was the end of your association with the Browns?
That was the end of my, yes.
I take it not everyone on the club was that way. You certainly don't strike me as being an alpha leather sword. I mean, how did you fit in with guys like Clary and Jakubi and so on? Did you just kind of mind your own business?
Oh, yes. I loved Jakubi. He was one of the all-time characters in baseball, really. One of the roughest, toughest guys, but one of the nicest, really. But he just loved to fight, that's all. He just,
so in other words, he didn't really bother anybody else.
He didn't bother anybody on our club.
Yeah.
No. There were a few battles Jakubi and Tex Shirley had it one time. Actually, I think it was just a one-punch fight. But we sort of had a run-in feud with the Chicago White Sox for some reason. And I don't know, for 3 or 4 years there, sometime during the season, there would be a free-for-all with the White Sox.
I think there was one at 45 with Carl Scheele, their bench jockey, right? George Caster threw the ball in their dugout,
right.
And you guys charged there.
Yeah, they had some ex-Marine in the dugout.
Carl Scheele.
I had forgotten his name, but that's all Dykes had him on the bench for, was to get on our ball club. So... They just took so much of that, and some of the players on our club, they just charged off. They poured out from the bench in the field and took off after him.
Yeah, Dykes commented on it. Moses didn't like it, but Moses seems to be a real gentleman and a quiet guy. He doesn't seem to be the type who would intentionally needle a guy.
No. You don't mind, like Adley Donald. I played, of course, with Adley Donald at Newark on the great Newark ball club. And Adley and I were great friends. But Adley Donald loved to sit on the top step of the dugout when we were playing the Yankees and needle me, you know. But it didn't bother me at all because I knew I would get my revenge against him when he pitched against us.
But it wasn't below the belt type.
No insults.
Really.
No insults. Now, you don't mind bench jockeying, I think it's good. But when you get personal, I think then it's not good. But that's all part of the game.
Apparently there was some bad blood with the Senators, too, because I know toward the end of the 44 season, didn't Johnny Niggling squeeze in a run, and then when Case went to bunt again, I guess he crossed the bag, and then he and Potter had words, and they went at it.
No, it wasn't Case and Potter. It was Ellis Clary and Gale House. Oh, no, maybe you were right. Maybe it was Gale House. It was Gale House and Clary, and it could have been Potter and Case. I believe you're right.
Oh, so when Clary played for Washington in 43, he and Gale House had a
set. That's right, Gale House threw Gale House threw a pitch that they almost thought Gale House threw at him. So he pushed the next ball down the first base line, you know, which is
running over Gale House.
Right. Yeah. But it just so happens that Ellis just wasn't big enough to compete against a big guy like Gale House. And he did run into Gale House, but he just bounced off of Gale House and went head over heels. But he came up fighting, you know, because it was a typical baseball fight. It didn't last any time. I don't think there was a punch thrown. In fact, it's one of the funniest stories that Ellis Clary tells. And a week later, and we all hated Clary's guts after that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But a week later, he was traded to the Browns. And he joined us in St. Louis. And he tells this story over and over. The day he walked into the clubhouse, we were all in the clubhouse getting ready to go out on the field. And he said when he walked down through the middle of that aisle, he, was like running the gauntlet, you know, in the old Indian fashion. He said he didn't know but what somebody was going to jump out of a locker and take a punch at him. And as I say, I hated, you know, after he did that to a nice guy like ALS, I hated that query, you know, just for the moment. But after he joined us and I got to know him, I roomed with the guy after that.
Oh, really?
You know, oh, yeah, I loved the guy.
Who were your other roommates besides Clary?
Oh, I had
during the Warriors.
Rip Radcliffe, mostly. And Gene Moore. Those two I roomed with.
I see. Well, let's move on. Oh, one other quick question before I move on to the series. Bob Ortiz had a big fight with one of the Brown players. I guess it was a catcher. Was it Tom Turner?
Tom Turner, yeah.
Okay.
And maybe I shouldn't tell this story, but Tom came out, I think he'd had a couple of beers. And for some reason, he didn't like Ortega. And he told us, before the game even started, he says, I'm going to get that Ortega. You know, he'd made up his mind. He was going to provoke him. And, and that's really what happened.
That's what I heard.
He just provoked the fight with Ortega. Yeah.
Had a big fight near the third base coaching box.
That's right.
And the two teams kind of formed a circle around Gallatin.
That's right.
And George Case and Lefty Lefevre told me about that.
That was a planned fight, which is unusual in baseball.
Let's move on to the 44 series. You were the Browns hitting star. I think you got a 438.
That's right.
You had a great day of the first game. Didn't you hit a homer with one eye? Was it off Cooper?
Yes.
Do you remember what the pitch was and where it landed?
Yes, I'll never forget it, really. The first time up, because I had batted against Cooper in a spring series. We'd always play the Cardinals 2 out of 3 in the spring, and I had faced Cooper before, and I knew he threw hard. But the first time up in that ball game, he threw me a fastball inside and he hit me on the fist, so to speak. In other words, the ball hit about at the trademark because it didn't get around on his fastball. And I popped it up to the shortstop. And for some reason, I just said to myself, if he ever throws that pitch to me again, he'll never hit me on the fist with it again. I'm going to be ready. So in I forget whether it was the fourth or fifth inning, Gene Moore, my roommate, singled to right field. And Cooper's first pitch to me when I walked up was he threw, I don't know, it was a palm ball, I believe it's a palm ball, which was low and away. I think he was just setting me up for the same pitch again. Because I hit a lot to the opposite field, in other words, the left field, and I think there strategy was to pitch me tight. So when he threw that first pitch outside, I said, here it comes. I just knew.
So you were waiting for the fastball
inside? I knew positively he was going to come back with that same pitch that he made me pop up on the first time. And I was ready for him. And I got out in front on the ball and I'd say it was the hardest ball I ever hit in my life.
No kidding. Did it get out there?
I just
hurry?
Didn't get it in the air enough, but I hit a line drive. It just cleared the right field roof by about a foot, I would say. But if I'd have raised it up in the air a little bit, I think they'd have still been talking about that home run.
All the way over everything, right?
Because it was up on the roof before I hardly got out of the batter's box. That's actually, if you want to stop it for a second,